Hello, Hyrule. Welcome back to the premiere Legend of Zelda Travelogue podcast. We are your tour guides. My name is Pete.
And my name's Chris. Hey, Pete.
Hello, hello.
So we're kind of in the second half of this season now. So naturally, we have to start thinking about our playthrough of the next game, in this case, Four Swords.
I'm not ready.
Well, too bad. Life comes at you quick. And I was thinking something fun that we could do for these future playthroughs for the show, if you're down for it, that is, would be, you know, the Zelda games have always had this ability to rename Link at the start of the game.
Oh.
And probably 95% of, you know, people who play Zelda games just name Link Link. I know I always have.
I don't know. I only recently started calling him Link. I think I'd be interested in seeing, like, a survey on that or something.
I would be interested, too. I don't know if we'll ever get that. But my suggestion was, I think that we should let each other name each other's Link for future seasons.
That's a twist I didn't see coming. Okay. Yeah, why not?
All right. So, Four Swords allows you six letters to a name.
Just six?
Yeah, just six. I counted. Oh. I just saw the character creator.
Okay.
So, do you want to come up with a six-letter name for me, and I'll come up with one for you, or?
Do you want to do that on the spot? Because I might want to concoct something pretty good.
I have one for you. But if you want to take it and think about it, then
I'm going to save mine for a future drum roll. But why don't you tell me what you got?
Okay. Your next version of Link will be Curtis.
Why?
I don't know. I looked up six letter names and I saw the word Curtis. And let me be clear, there's nothing wrong with the name Curtis, but I love the sound of the Legend of Curtis. So Pete's next playthrough of Four Swords will be the Legend of Curtis.
Well, hang on there, because then Zelda's name is Curtis then at that point, isn't it?
Well, a Curtis to the past. Fair point.
A Curtis between worlds.
A Curtis between worlds.
I gotta think, okay, I need to think of a name. Remind me before next episode, because I gotta think of a name that will, you know, how people tend to call Link a name that comes up in dialogue in unexpected ways.
Oh boy, yeah, you could certainly choose to do that to me if you want to. Me, the person who takes a lot of notes about the dialogue in these games, please feel free to make it impossible to do my job.
I know what, because there's six letters, I know what I want your Link to be called.
Uh-oh.
You're going to have to mess with capitalization or something here, because it's going to take up all six and normally would need a space, okay?
I don't know if that's possible, but I will certainly try.
Your name will be oh, dang.
Okay, I think we could do that.
Oh, dang, you need to save the princess.
I like it. I like it. I'm actually kind of excited. Anyway, Pete, do you want to give us a recap for what we discussed last episode?
We got sidetracked pretty heavily when trying to make it to Lake Hylia. We spent a long time at the library reading and discussing a lot of books.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we're well-read individuals. What can we say?
Also tracking down the books of several delinquent book borrowers, as along with retrieving both the power bracelet and the flippers.
Oh, yeah. Big suit-up episode for Link last episode.
Yeah, huh? We were busy. And once we were able to actually dive in to Lake Hylia, we stopped right at the entrance of the Temple of Droplets.
All right, so another temple episode. This one is actually a super cool temple. This was probably one of the more memorable temples in this game for me.
I thought it was sweet. This is one of my favorite in the game.
It's a very long one. There are a lot of puzzles in this one. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are kind of small. Like, yeah. There's no big stumpers in this, similar to some of the cloning puzzles in the last temple. But some cool stuff.
Can I real quick boil down the puzzle nature of this dungeon?
Please do.
Push the blocks, light the torches. Push the blocks, light the torches. Chris, push the... I don't see you pushing. Push the blocks, and light the torch.
I think you're being very reductive. I think the theme is push the blocks, light the torches on ice.
Yeah, I mean, we don't push a lot of blocks in this game to begin with, but when you get, spoilers, there's ice floors in here.
Oh, this is the ice dungeon,
yeah.
I would say.
Oh yeah, for sure. And ice floors in a Zelda game typically have only two functions, one of which is to push blocks around in a puzzle. And the other is to get knocked off of ice platforms by annoying enemies.
Yeah, and this game has both in spades.
Uh-huh.
So what I will say, though, in this dungeon's defense is, I feel like games of that era, there were like one of two ways of handling ice. There was one way, which this game does, where like your controls are just a little bit looser. Like it takes a little bit longer to stop.
Yeah.
There's also like the approach of, once you hit the ice, you go flying in the direction that you touched the ice in until you hit a wall.
Ooh.
And I'm very glad that it's not one of those, for what it's worth.
I mean, any blocks that you push do have that effect, though, which is kind of the whole challenge.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that is a big part of the puzzles, as we will be discussing in some of these rooms. Do you want to give... I guess we're kind of given the description already.
Ice Dungeon.
Yeah, Ice Dungeon. Also kind of like a big lily pad section, like ice/water dungeon, kind of all wrapped up in one.
It cuts throughout most of this place. You got like one of those lily pad moats.
Mm-hmm. So overall, this is a very blue, as far as color palette goes, dungeon.
Everything's frozen over, which we find out later that this is because of the presence of the water element.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's in the figurine description for the boss. Apparently, the water element has, like, the nature of it freezes this whole place over.
That's very cool.
Yeah, isn't it rad? Which, by the way, something that I love about this, because this is a tiny dungeon, which we haven't had since the first, I think. And we dive in, and you see all the, like, bits of nature frozen under the ice. Like, you see, like, four-leaf clovers and sticks and such that are frozen beneath you.
Uh-huh.
It's a great touch.
It's a very good touch. There's also sort of the reoccurring Zelda trope of opening up the ceiling and letting light into the dungeon.
Yeah, although usually in Zelda, that is because you have a mirror shield to reflect light somewhere.
Here, it's more so just to melt the ice and do some of those fun 3D tricks that we've seen in previous dungeons.
Right. Well, to melt specific ice...
Very specific ice.
If it's ice you can push around, then sunlight can melt it. If it's the ice you were standing on, gracefully, it does not melt. Could you imagine that became a danger in here? You suddenly just melt the entire dungeon?
I mean, I kind of like the idea of that. Actually, that's going to tie into a specific room that I have some questions about later on in the dungeon.
Right on.
Yeah, anything else in the general description of this dungeon, though?
The music here slaps.
I don't remember it, but I'm excited to edit it into the episode and revisit it.
Yeah, no, this music is just extremely good. This soundtrack, I never, like, paid it much mind the first time I played this game, Chris, but, like, now it's one of my favorite soundtracks in Zelda.
It's a good one. And the nice thing, as opposed to Skyward Sword soundtrack, is there's only, like, 15 tracks in this one. Skyward Sword... When we did that Swordies episode, I spent like 4 hours listening to Skyward Sword songs in preparation.
Too long. You should wing your list like I do.
For what it's worth, I really enjoyed those few hours. But yeah, that was maybe too much.
The other thing, though, Chris, is that I don't know if you picked up on this, but this dungeon has a secondary theme apart from ice.
What would that be?
Pottery.
Are you saying it's a theme of the dungeon because a bunch of ghost pots get launched at you throughout the dungeon?
That is merely one facet of what I'm getting at.
Okay, go on.
Take a look, if you have it available, take a look at the map for this dungeon.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at the map. I guess it kind of looks like it's in the shape of a pot. Am I looking at the right thing?
Both floors look like pots. They got like the...
Yeah.
They got the rim at the top and like it's like... You know, onion shaped and such.
Okay, I could see that. And there is also obviously the little pot at the bottom of the pot, which we'll be talking about when we dive into the rooms themselves.
Yeah, there's like pot shapes all over. If you look at like the tiles, I think, if I recall, there's certain rooms where the tiles, either the floor or the walls, I don't remember, have like pot symbology on it.
Okay, yeah, I guess you're right.
This, I could just be making this up from whole cloth based on the things that I see, but like, since we already know that the Minish are responsible, lore-wise, for why there's special goodies hidden in pots sometimes, whether or not there's some kind of special meaning to them, about what pots are?
I mean, especially because Minish are the only ones fitting into this dungeon, right?
For sure. I mean, they also have Minish portals left around town that are big blue pots.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It definitely seems intentional. What it means, I can't fully piece together on the spot.
Oh, but yeah. No clue what the implications of this are. It's just like something that I found very interesting.
I'm with you. Yeah. You've convinced me. So yeah, let's talk about the enemies that are found here.
You know, Chris, I've been dabbling with the idea of calling, like making a segment out of this. Like one or two episodes ago, I referred to this as the menu.
Oh, no. Ew. Because we just...
Yeah, no. I abandoned that idea. Because like every so often you have enemies that are just like humanoids, like dark nuts and such. And like, that doesn't feel kosher. I'm not cool with that.
I agree. And I spent part of the last episode talking about eating one of Tingle's brothers. So,
hey, bud, that is on you.
I know. I have to live with the repercussions of my actions.
So do we have anything new in here, or is it just like enemies we've all seen before?
We have two new things that I can see, but they're kind of bottom of the barrel. And that's not a judgment call on my part, but like there are no figurine entries even for these two new additions.
You're talking about, okay, so these two things that I think you're referring to, I'm not sure if I would refer to them as enemies per se.
Would you refer to them as traps?
More traps than enemies. I just blanket describe them as dangers.
I think that's a fair word to use.
But yeah, no, as far as dangers / traps, etc., you got your face lamps, which you talked about. You got spike traps. You got traps also, regular traps. You got something new called winders.
Which is a line of flames.
Yeah, you know in Mario, you got like the fire bars, but you turn that into a snake and it can kind of just like go around walls like a spark does.
Mm-hmm. What is with this era of games and just making lines of fire as an enemy? Like, they could have made, like, an insect, like a fire insect or something. It's just interesting.
I think they wanted to introduce something that you can't kill. Because if you could just kill winders, then the rooms they are in would become, like, 100% easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the other new trap, flying pots.
Yeah. Similar to flying skulls, I don't really consider them enemies for... The reason that, like, they don't require combat to destroy. Like, they just hone in on your last known position and blow up against a wall.
It's kind of exactly the same thing, yeah, that we've seen in other forms.
Sure. And it makes no sense to have skulls in here, so, you know, here we are.
Smart change. I actually am totally on board for reskinning an enemy to make it thematically appropriate, even if the behavior is exactly the same.
Sure, I agree with that. I mean... Also, you know, there's the funny detail that there's no miniatures for these. Like, the description would just be like, they do a fly at you. Watch out. And that's it.
See, when I saw these two new enemies, I was excited to crack into the figurines because I figured maybe they got a little weird in them.
Minish magic because they love pottery so much.
I also just wanted any indication as to what a winder is as opposed to five balls of flame.
Yeah, maybe that's also a reason, like they didn't have a reason, so here we are.
Which is fair. I guess they didn't anticipate that thousands of people in the year 2020 would have way too deep dive podcasts on their thing, discussing every little detail.
Hey, Chris, why are winders here in the ice dungeon?
Okay, let's get right into it. The location where we first see the winder is on an ice platform, an ice puzzle.
Yeah.
What?
What up? What's good? Hey, game devs, you good?
You have to ice skate past these things, and it's just like, you see sunlight melt ice throughout this whole dungeon. Why would this literal line of fires not do that?
Do you think we could write this off with the effect of the water element?
No, because again, you're using sunlight to melt through so much of the ice, even with the water element.
Only certain bits of ice, though. There's sunlight which breaks, like, movable ice blocks, and then you get an item later on that lets you melt other bits of ice in this dungeon. None of it actually melts the floors.
Yeah.
I know that this is not what permafrost means, but this is what I think of when I think of the word permafrost. It is just permanently frozen.
For sure. Yeah. It's just a little bit, like, inconsistent. But, I mean, it's inconsistent for the sake of creating a fun dungeon to play through, not, like...
Well, you think about that, too. If you... Who knows what would happen if you could actually melt the ice floors? You could fall straight through back into the lake.
That would be interesting. Imagine, like, this just launches you out of the dungeon.
Yeah.
And you have to go, oh, that would be such a hassle.
I mean, that's kind of part of the problem of the divine beasts in Breath of the Wild, right?
There's at least one of them that I can remember that you fall right out of.
I think I fell out of the elephant and the camel at least once each. Like, and it's not that hard at times. Like, you slip on a banana peel and suddenly you're back in Lake Hylia.
As someone who has just restarted playing Breath of the Wild, I am maybe not terribly excited about potentially falling through that again.
You chose this life, Chris.
It is a very cool moment the first time it happens, for about 5 seconds.
Yeah, because you have this Shadow of the Colossus moment where you're falling off of the big beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love it. All right.
Back to enemies, though. Here we got blue muldozers, red muldozers, scissors beetles, slugula, red pestos, and blue pestos, which we never actually encountered yet until now.
So the red pestos are the ones that fly around holding dung and dropping it down at you, right?
The blue ones are the ones that carry the balls of stuff, Chris.
Oh, excuse me. The balls of stuff. So just what stuff. What do the red ones do?
They just fly around and annoy you.
Okay.
No, it's funny. I was actually wrong. Back in season one, we encountered the Gwei, which leaves a little poop on your head.
Mm-hmm.
This is now the second enemy that'll drop poop on you.
Two for two. That is very funny. I wonder at the end of our journeys through Hyrule, what the ratio will be in regards to games where something poops on
life. We're going to have to take a tally as we go throughout this franchise now.
All right. Well, like I said, two for two so far. Anyway, we enter this dungeon. Ezlo says he's freezing and he's going to turn into a hatsicle. Just some more quality humor from Ezlo.
I mean, I guess that's... He could be right, though, because you just popped out of the lake, so he's all wet.
Mm-hmm. And again, as someone who's playing through Breath of the Wild again right now, I am happy that we do not have to actually manage Link's temperature in any tangible way throughout this dungeon.
In a 2D game, that would be a nightmare.
That would be a lot of work. Some of the early rooms in this is where you really see the opening the ceiling to get sunlight down stuff shine through, I guess. There's that room early on with the muldozers that has the openable floor, mm-hmm. and then we open the ceiling from above, and then the light just kind of comes right through and melts the boss key. In, like, the second or third room here.
You get the boss key at the start of the dungeon.
It's wild, right?
I can't think of any other game that does this.
It is a cool little, like, subversion within the game itself, where you get the boss key very early on, and you'll discover you cannot use it.
No, you do use it.
You do use it, yeah.
The thing is that, like, the dungeon just keeps going after you use it.
If you use a boss key and it just brings you to the rest of the dungeon, is it really a boss key?
Well, they don't really call it a boss key, though, do they? It's the big key.
Okay, we know
That's what that is.
No. We know what that is. You don't get to, like, adapt iconography like that and then say, it's just a small, it does the small key thing. It does the same thing.
Here's the thing, though, Chris. You unlock the big door with the big key and you do find the boss.
You do. Oh, let's talk about this moment. I love this.
It's so cool. You bust into this room, which has some flying pots in it, just be warned.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk straight down, you find the water element frozen in ice.
Oh, it's right there.
Yeah.
I'm sure we just have to find a ceiling above it to open, and the light will just melt it, right?
Or failing that, just chip away with your sword. I think that could probably solve the problem.
Hey, there you go. But alas, that is not necessarily what we need to do here. This is the main hub room of pretty much the whole dungeon. But most importantly, there's a giant frozen Octorok feet away from this element.
Mm-hmm.
Hoo boy.
That is so rad. Like, we already had the thing in the first dungeon where you fight the giant choo-choo.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have a giant Octorok, another classic Zelda enemy, and you know you're gonna fight it, right? You don't see this and think, like, well, it's frozen, I guess I'm safe.
Yeah, you see it and you kind of just sigh. You know what's coming. So yeah, from here we have some subsequent rooms with swimming portions.
Oh, a lot of swimming, Chris. You're going to be like darting around. I mean, when you're not riding on lily pads, because you do need that also sometimes.
Yeah, there's also using our newly acquired flippers to dive under spike traps.
And pestos, actually, because there does come a point in this dungeon where I just am completely done with pestos. I don't want to deal with them anymore, so I'm just ducking under the water so I can leave the current room.
They are the bokoblin of this dungeon, specifically. There's also the stone slab in a room coming up that says, the way forward is hidden in the bottom of the pot. And you think, oh, wow, what, that's so obscure. What a weird metaphor. I have no idea. Then you just swim about 5 feet to the right, and there is just a big pot carving in the water.
They really did not bury the lead with this puzzle at all, huh? It's just like, here's where it is. It's in the next room. Go get it.
It's kind of just like this horseshoe-looking rock structure. And you go to the quote-unquote bottom of it, dive down, and you'll get a small key.
Chris, can you read the text on that stone slab one more time?
The way forward is hidden in the bottom of the pot.
Is there any world or reality where in this story, that phrase has some sort of meaning to the Minish that we're not aware of?
Well, I mean, you're the one who pointed out that this whole dungeon is a pot, right?
Uh-huh.
So, like, let's look at what is at the bottom of the map, technically.
Oh, that's a good point. What is at the bottom of the map?
So, there are two floors, and on the basement floor, there's three floors, but
basement three is one square.
It's one square. So there are two floors. In the second floor basement, this pot is the bottom of it. And in the first floor basement, it's the boss room. So I guess kind of.
It's true in both floors, though. That's pretty cool.
There you go. I guess that is pretty cool. I wasn't really expecting it to go that extra layer. So we find ourselves kind of back at the top of the water section, but this time now there is a lily pad that we can use, that we can ride on.
You gotta ride it all over the place. Like, I remember this part going pretty long.
Yeah, you retread all of your steps and you are pushing the lily pad all the way through. It's kind of fun to ride the lily pad. It's like any longer than they did it in this dungeon and it would probably become a chore. And I think arguably it became a chore in this dungeon, but
I want to agree that it's not that bad because I enjoy the idea, like the aesthetic of riding on a gigantic lily pad. That's very, it feeds my soul, Chris. But now that we're able to swim wherever we want, riding the lily pad at all feels very tedious because you got to direct it with the gust jar.
I mean, fortunately, these rooms are wide open enough that you don't get stuck in a bunch of corners. But yeah, we end up finding ourselves in a matter pillar battle, one of two in this dungeon.
This is one of two or three dungeons in this game that actually has multiple mini bosses.
I mean, if you consider the matter pillar fight a mini boss, this has like arguably three mini bosses.
What's the third one?
So there are two matter pillar fights and there's a choo-choo fight.
Right, but what's the third one?
This first one is a single matter pillar.
Oh, there's a solo matter pillar in here. Oh, okay. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah. Once you beat the solo matter pillar, you get a compass, which, all right, fair enough.
It's helpful if you're trying to 100% the dungeon.
And shortly after that initial matter pillar fight, you find a large room switch, one that Link can't by any means push by himself. But luckily, there is a cloning pad like 5 feet away.
Yeah, I'm already kind of over the cloning bit, to be honest, Chris.
It's just like also when you're trying to like say, hey, why is this thing here logically in the in this world? It just becomes a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Like, do you think Picori can clone themselves? Did we discuss this in a previous episode? And I'm just forgetting.
No, we didn't. That's a whole new thought.
If this dungeon is a Picori inhabited or a Picori created structure, then if they're able to use these pads, then I can see a reason why it would exist and why maybe they would be using it for these switches. But I mean,
I don't know how much of a stretch we need to make because the Picori blade or the Four Sword is a Minish invention.
Sure.
So who's to say they might have, you know, possibly as like a religious or whatever artifact of theirs, they might have brought it here from time to time for whatever reason.
Oh, that seems like such an inconvenience just to open a switch.
I guess, yeah, but
and it's like how they turn on the heating in here. It's like on a summer day. Oh, I got to get the blade from the backyard. All right, bring it in. We got to get up on the second floor.
And the backyard is like a 5-day trek.
Yeah, not the most convenient layout, but you know, it is what it is. Anyway, we clone ourselves. We're able to push this floor switch and we see it open the ceiling in the room with the frozen element. Problem is, it only opens the ceiling on the right side of that room. And it doesn't successfully melt the element or the Octorok.
Why? Why not?
Because we have to do the second half of the dungeon, Pete.
Yeah, sure, gamey-wamey, but like, what is the why would half of the ice not melt?
Okay, listen, this is obviously well before a time of central air conditioning, right? So like, sometimes it's a little bit too cold and you want it to be warmer, but you don't want it to be blazing hot, right? So you open half of the ceiling, you don't open the full ceiling.
I guess that doesn't really explain my question, but...
Well, it certainly explained the question I was thinking in my own head.
Fine, fair enough. They had the most complicated skylight in existence in this dungeon, so we gotta keep moving.
So we kind of make our way all the way back to the main room, and we're heading into the right side of this dungeon. There is a room with some tight ice paths where traps are just circling a portion of ice.
Right.
Like the enemy named traps. I'm going to send you the screenshot because I want to discuss this, right? Because we read the figurine for traps, I believe, and we know what they are. They are given to the Wind Tribe as a form of security. What is happening in this picture that I sent you, Pete? Do you want to describe this picture and what you think could be happening?
Well, it's not security. I'll start with that. It is a almost perfect square of traps traveling in a line around the perimeter of a square ice platform. Possibly the most dangerous thing I've seen.
It's the equivalent of, like, you know how some people are super into, like, collecting trains? And, like, they'll put, like, trains around their Christmas tree, their holiday tree, or whatever? This is, like, the Minish getting into that hobby with traps. They're just, like, putting fun things around the room at this point.
Considering that this dungeon is Minish size, this is effectively a garbage disposal.
That's a good point.
If you stick your normal human hand into this thing, you're going to lose a finger.
It's just such a puzzle. Like, obviously, it's like a fun video game thing to get past. We know that. We know that.
But what does it mean? What does it mean, though?
Yes, in a world where everything has to mean something. What does it mean? Anyway, shortly after this, we get to this dungeon's proper mini boss, the big blue electric choo-choo.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
So yeah, this is a variation on the first dungeon boss. I think it's faster. I mean, yeah, let's describe it. It's blue. It is definitely faster. And it does the electricity attack.
Second verse, same as the first, except you add electricity.
Yes. And I think we have documented our feelings on electric enemies and electric choo-choo specifically at least three times now.
Chris, are there any blue choo-choo in or around Lake Hylia?
No, this is it, right?
There are no blue choo-choo in or around Lake Hylia. There are green choo-choo on the surrounding, you know, land masses around, but that's it.
Now, let's discuss some of the things that we've learned and the things that we know true at this point, because I think this is where Vati goes from being just a disgruntled, you know, young lad to being someone who maybe should go to jail. We know from video games and maybe from real life that you shouldn't toss electricity in water. It's a dangerous thing.
Sure.
The electricity is going to pass through the water and do a lot of damage.
Right.
We also know that Vati is responsible for these things being launched into all of these areas, right?
More or less.
Vati is conducting electricity through all of Lake Hylia. I mean... That's terrible.
that depends, doesn't it? Because we don't know what, like, the salinity of Lake Hylia is. We don't know how well electricity is conducted around this area. Also, the whole place is frozen.
Not the whole place. There's enough water. There's a fair amount of water stuff in here. In here, there is water stuff in the dungeon that is located in a lake.
Yes.
I think there's an abundance of water in the area.
An abundance of water, for sure. But, like, it's also later going to be occupied by something called Sea Zora. What is a sea? Salt water.
Sure. Fair enough. But right now, it's certainly not.
Also, Chris, you think this is the time where Vati should go to jail? I'm pretty sure we saw him do a few assaults towards the start.
Yeah, listen, I'm not saying I was on his side up to this point. I'm just saying this is some particularly cruel stuff.
He launched soldiers into the horizon like Team Rocket. I'm pretty sure he's going to jail no matter what.
Speaking of particularly cruel stuff, fighting this guy, I mean, it's really just a matter of it's going to shoot electricity at you and you have to kind of just sit and wait for it to not. And then you fight it the way that you fight the first boss. Then you use the gust jar to pull in its base and then swipe it in the head.
Yeah. No, it's pretty simple, to be honest.
So this was just the mini boss. It wasn't the big boss. We know what the big boss is going to be. We beat this guy and we get the flame lantern.
Pretty good item.
I like this item. Yeah. Do you want to talk about what it is?
It's a lantern.
There you go.
If you look at the art for it, it seems to be missing like a frame and such. Like it's just meant to hold like a magic candle. Which you can turn on or off at will, and also melt some ice and set certain enemies on fire.
Yeah, I kind of like it. So it is an equipable item. It's not a passive item, which makes sense. So you use it to illuminate some dark areas in some future.
Oh, yeah. It does light up the dark, doesn't it? Because there's like maybe two max dark rooms in here.
Yeah, you're suddenly going to come across a bunch of dark rooms in this dungeon that previously had none.
Light the lanterns, push the blocks.
But other than that, it's pretty much exactly what you said. You can use it to attack a few enemies.
I think it is possibly the best version of a lantern that you get in the franchise. Because I've been going through the lantern items and light making items for that tabletop RPG that's very slowly happening.
Nice.
And as far as like lantern and light making items, this is the only one that you can just turn on and off at will and does not require any sort of magic or oil or fuel of any kind.
The removal of the magic requirement is very welcome in this game.
Yeah, that's tight. It's pretty good.
It's not quite a fire rod. Fire rods are a lot of fun all the time, but it's still pretty good.
Fire rod, you're going to be shooting fire around. You can't exactly carry it with you.
Yeah. From here, we have some rooms with the scissor beetle battles. I just have a note that this was a point where I started to miss our beetle buddy.
Oh, me too now. Thanks, Chris.
So we essentially have to light lamps to illuminate the room as we fight these scissor beetles, which are kind of pests. But not too bad. Here is where I have my notes about the room with the fire enemies on ice, because they start popping up here. I feel like we ragged on the cloning ability so hard in the Elemental Sanctuary episode that in each subsequent dungeon, I'm going to try to find one instance of them doing a cool thing with it to kind of make up for it.
Did we rag on it, really?
Oh, yeah, because for what it's worth, listen, I kind of stand by the ragging to some extent because it is not that exciting as far as a twist goes for these games. But they do cool puzzle things with it occasionally. And in this upcoming room, they have one puzzle where they have clone pads on the right side of the room. And then they have a bunch of stone structures from the right side to the left side of the room. And you've got to like clone yourself on the right side of the room. And then kind of weave above and below the stone structures while on ice.
Oh, yeah.
It's not too difficult. But, I mean, as we discussed, like, if your clone bangs into anything, it's going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be very precise.
I'm glad the clones become more solid in the later games.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're fully corporeal, aren't they?
Yeah, they have their own independence, too. They don't have to do this weird mirror game.
Yeah, definitely a step up in that regard. After that, there is the dual matter pillar fight, which occurs in the dark on ice, I believe.
Oh, that's right.
Which is just everything in the kitchen sink getting thrown at you at once, I guess, to some extent.
Anything to make matter pillars more of a threat.
Followed by our next big switch room. To shine sunlight on the left half of the element, melting it along with the Octorok.
Okay.
And you want to talk about what happens immediately?
We celebrate a little too soon, and the Octorok sucks up the element like a big jerk.
Yep, and he backs up into his arena. I mean, as we discussed, this whole thing is the boss room, quote-unquote, maybe, but he's got his own arena right behind him.
Real quick, Chris, while we're here, and we have a moment before we have to face down the Octorok, do we want to, step aside for our Hyrule business highlight?
Yeah, why not? That's like the build-up, this very big cliffhanger, this suspenseful moment. Let's talk about the end.
You know, there's something where we're going that you have not been able to touch until you have the Flame Lantern. And it kind of bugged me for a while. So if it bugged you, then this is the perfect time to go to the inn.
Oh, I don't think I know what you're referring to, but yeah, let's figure it out. So we're talking today in our Hyrule business highlight about the Happy Hearth Inn in Eastern Hyrule Town.
That's right. A place that's, for the most part, can go pretty much ignored.
Largely, yes. But it also kind of secretly has one of the top three little side quests, I think, in this game.
Three side quests? I can only think of the one.
I think this one side quest is one of the top three, I think, overall
game. Oh, right on. I mean. Math is hard. Don't look at me like that.
So we enter the Happy Hearth Inn, and we're greeted to three potentially familiar looking characters.
This is at the top floor of the Happy Hearth, by the way, not the entrance.
Oh, okay. To be perfectly honest with you, I forgot about every floor of this business other than the one floor that is
okay,
particularly
well, let's start from the back and make our way to the front desk, because I have some stuff to say about the business practices of the Happy Hearth Inn, Chris.
On the top floor, as I mentioned, there is a room with three characters. It's Din, Ferora, Nehru.
From the Oracle games.
From the Oracle games, yeah.
Two of my favorite games, and here they are, right here.
It's wild. So we meet them here, and they're talking about how they're visiting, and they would like to find a place to stay in the town.
Are they staying in this empty room for now, Chris?
I guess, yeah. They must be renting a single room in the inn.
A single empty stone room.
I mean, there is the flame in the room. What else is going on in this room? Not a whole lot, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of sad. And they might be like the cheapest rates they could afford.
Oh, I don't like the thought of that. But yeah, maybe. Well, there are a few pots.
They are goddesses, question mark?
I don't think they're goddesses in this game. Look, you have more familiarity with the Oracle games than I do.
Okay.
And I don't know if these characters are directly the same ones from those games.
No. I mean, if we're going timeline order, they're definitely not, because like this is like generations and generations away.
Right.
They do closely resemble those Oracles, but there's no way that that's the case.
So we can fuse Kinstones with any given one of them, and doing so makes Gorman come to town.
Gorman, which we talked about just a couple episodes ago.
Aspiring entrepreneur Gorman. He hangs out outside an empty house in Hyrule, and he mentions how he needs to rent this house out, but he's looking for specifically a single resident and one who is female, because multiple residents or male residents cause too many tenants, or they are too loud, or they make the place dirty.
I guess I can't disprove that.
No, you know what? Hey, I get it. I get it. We are slobs.
Well, speak for yourself on that, man. That's...
I will. I'm a slob. I actually, no, you're right. You are a much cleaner, neater person than I am. I do know that about you.
I guess it's bad enough. This is like across the street from a hen house. So like they have enough trouble as it is around the place.
And that place we know is a mess. And not only is that place a mess, but they're causing a mess throughout the whole town.
Yeah, every 5 seconds.
At this point, we can go back and talk to any of the given goddesses and tell them they can rent this location. They can rent this house that Gorman is in front of.
Chris, who did you pick to move into this house?
Do you want to pick who you think I chose and I'll pick who you think you chose?
Wait, you want us to guess each other's picks?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to say you picked Nehru.
No.
Really? Okay.
Nehru. Who did? I think I'm going to say I bet you chose Ferror.
You are correct.
I knew it. I chose Din.
What tipped you off?
You are the type of person who would always pick the freaky little green one.
Freaky little green. That's it? That was your whole reason?
Yep. I was right.
Here's the thing. I figured there was only going to be one house. So I went to Faror because in the Oracle games, Faror has almost no part. Because Oracle of Ages is Nehru. Oracle of Seasons is Din. And they play parts in the plot.
Yeah.
Faror is just off to the side, calls herself the Oracle of Secrets, and doesn't really do much.
I guess now is as good of a time as any to talk about that. This whole quest is an Easter egg that is a nod to the fact that initially those Oracle games were supposed to be three games.
Oh, so you mean the fact that only two of these people get a house and the third does not? That's a reference?
It is 100% a reference to that. Remember, those games were also developed by Capcom, and there was a troubled development history that happened when they were making those games. One of the things that happened was Miyamoto came in and said, hey, we have to consolidate. This will no longer be a trilogy of game. This will be two games.
Ooh.
And it was one of the things, the decisions they made to get the development back on track.
Okay, that makes sense why they picked Faror to be like the go-between. Because through her in those games, she would let you use passwords to get stuff from either game.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of cool.
Okay, let's read Faror's in-game figurine. She's looking for a house in Hyrule to move into. She's a very helpful person, but people take advantage of her kind nature. This really bothers her.
Ugh.
Them putting this in is also kind of a nod to the fact that she got the short end of the stick and never got her own focused game in that trilogy.
Well, heck yeah. Of course we're going to pick her to get a house then, man.
And that's kind of why every time these rumors of the Oracle games being remade pops up, everyone's like, they're going to do it and they're going to make the third game, which is like, they're not going to do it. They're not.
No. If anything, they might just make like one united game. You know what I mean? Just call it Oracle of Secrets. And that is just the title for the combined HD collection.
Maybe. Yeah.
Like you get like Pokemon Red and Pokemon Blue, but Pokemon Yellow has the full Pokedex.
Okay, so anyway, we choose one of these two residents and we talk to them and they say, oh, you have a house to show me? Which is like, they say that to Link. And I just think like, what's Gorman's role in this?
Well, I mean,
you're the one showing the house.
Grown man says to little boy, go find me someone to live in this house. Already buck wild. Little boy goes to three grown women living out of an inn at the moment. And says, hey, I got a house. Any single one of those grown women then says, hey, little boy, you're on to something. I'll go check out this house.
Yeah. One of the cool things is after you talk to one of these three people, the next time you go to that house, you'll see on the outside, there's like a clothesline and you'll see different color clothes on the clothesline based on the goddess or the resident you chose, which is a fun little detail.
I think it's kind of neat.
You choose someone to live in this first house. You go talk to them and they thank you and they give you an item. Do you remember what they give you?
No.
They give you a charm, and each of the individual characters have different charms.
Yes. You can continue to get charms from them later for a cash fee, I think.
No, I think it's always free. It's just you always have to go back to them.
Oh, right. They put it into a bottle, though, don't they?
They do. So I chose Din, and her charm boosted my strength, turning my tunic red.
Oh, it changes your color?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool. I never used them.
I used it once and then kind of never went back.
Well, that's kind of neat.
I know that if you choose Nehru, it'll strengthen defense. And I'm not sure what Faror does.
So it was strength, defense. I have to guess speed, right?
Faror's charm will increase Link's attack and defense.
Oh, both?
Yeah.
Okay.
So although both attributes are increased, the individual boosts from Din's charm or Nehru's charm are higher.
Okay.
So it's like 50% of both or 100% of either individual one.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to have, you know, a lesser boost of both. That sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, none of it's really necessary. The game's fairly easy, but I mean, yeah, why not?
There is one other thing about these three sisters? Question mark?
Who knows?
Is that later on you have the ability to perform a Kinstone fusion with any one of the three. And when you do that, it spawns something out in the world called a joy butterfly. Do you know about this?
No. Nope.
I wasn't sure if you were messing with me for a sec there. If you fuse with them, then a joy butterfly comes into existence. There's one of each for each oracle, and they spawn in three different places. Faror's spawns in Caster Wilds, and it increases your digging speed with the Mole Mitts.
Interesting.
Dins spawns in the Wind Ruins and increases your shooting speed with the bow. Very good.
Oh, that sounds good.
Nehru's actually spawns in the location we're going to next episode, and it increases your swimming speed.
And these are permanent boosts?
Mm-hmm.
I like that more than the other thing, the charms.
It's much better.
That's awesome. And I guess really quick, while we're on the topic, reading through Din and Nehru's figurines, Nehru, it does say that she's descended from a line of oracles in the land of Labrina.
Oh, there you go.
And Din is a famous dancer from the land of Holodrum. So I guess these are literally the same characters.
They must be similar. Okay, so now we're back on your playoff of my theory a few episodes ago, Chris, where essentially anybody who's ever like interacted with Link or Zelda also gets reincarnated.
I'm telling you, that seems to be the case.
There's a second house, not vacant, but has to be built. It's built on top of a pre-existing Minish Mushroom house, mm-hmm. which is a shame. But when you go into that house later, that same Minish has set up a new, improved home.
Basically, we talked to Bremer from the N64 games, fused Kinstones with him, and you see Muto says he suddenly has motivation to build a new house. He says, I could probably build a good-sized house in a matter of minutes. Which is like, what?
And no charge either.
No, he just does it.
So I guess all these houses in town and on the outskirts of town are all just prefab?
I guess so. I guess every now and then he just gets a random burst of energy and builds a whole house in a few minutes.
It's an inefficient business practice.
We essentially are able to enter and exit houses a couple of times, and we could see the framework get built and then the full house get built. Like if you enter and exit the house that you're in, mm-hmm. you'll see the framework of a new house be built right next to it. And then the full house the next time you enter and exit.
Wow, that is lightning fast.
Mm-hmm. And then this plays out just like the last time. We could talk to one of the three characters and tell them, hey, why not live here?
Well, not just that. This house is created on a whim by the carpenters in town. And then Gorman comes by and says, empty house. I should sell this.
Young boy.
You, boy on the street, sell my house.
Yeah. The fact that Gorman has any money, it should make everyone very angry.
I mean, here might be the trick, though. He didn't have anything to do with the house's creation. And as far as we're aware, he didn't speak to Muto or any of the carpenters to own it.
Not that we saw.
He found an empty house and said, this is mine, I'm gonna sell it.
Mm-hmm. Landlords, am I right?
Oh, don't get me started.
Is there anything else in particular about the inn that you want to talk about?
Yeah, there's two things. The first is, when you have the flame lantern, there is a spot on the second floor towards the south end of the building, where there's one or two lanterns that you can light up. And when you do, a door unlocks and opens and goes out into a balcony out in town. And on that balcony, there is a chest that holds 200 rupees.
Not bad.
Not bad. Not quite worth the wait, though, because you see that chest sitting there in town for half the game.
Fair point, yeah.
But the main thing I really want to talk about here in the Happy Hearth, Chris, is the rooms.
Okay.
There are three rooms for rent here in the Happy Hearth Inn. There are a lot of other patrons who are also renting rooms somewhere, where I don't know, because all the rooms are vacant and available for you. But there's three. There's a cheap room, a regular room, and a luxury room. You pay increasing amounts of money for each room, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Nice lady at the counter asks you which room you want to pay for. And when you do, you are immediately swept away into your room and you wake up in bed with Eslo. Very cute animation. And there is a chest that you can open that has a kinstone in it. Mm-hmm. I guess as like a special prize or a gift for staying with them.
Yep.
So in the cheap room, which costs 50 rupees, you get a green kinstone. Same price as the Goron merchant outside. In the regular room, for 200 rupees, you get a blue kinstone. Same price as the Goron merchant outside. In the luxury room, for 400 rupees, you get a red kinstone, which is 100 rupees more expensive than the Goron merchant outside.
Why would you do this?
And again, you don't know what shape kinstone you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be entirely unhelpful.
That is very silly. You said the third one is a red one?
Yeah.
So the thing we do know, though, is the red kinstones, regardless of the shape, do generally lead to the more valuable treasures.
Sure, they're more rare for that reason, too.
Yes. But yeah, that is, why not just, if you know that, if you have all of that information at your disposal, just go to the merchant if you really need to.
It's the same result. The only difference, I guess, is that you're not getting well rested in a bed. I think this also, like, fills up your hearts.
Probably.
But, you know, swipe at some grass for 5 minutes. You'll get the same result, man.
In general, just adventure more. Don't go to the merchant or the inn. Just adventure more. You'll get rupees. You'll get hearts. That's the game.
It sounds like we're endorsing grind culture, and I want to be clear that we're not.
No. It's just, you don't really, in my casual playthrough of this, I never stayed at the inn, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I only did it to check out what was in the rooms. I was kind of disappointed.
Mm-hmm. All right, so anything else about the Happy Hearth Inn before we move on?
Bad room service. Rooms are too expensive, and I'm not happy with them playing into the current trend on the street these days.
Thank you for staying at the Happy Hearth Inn. On that note, we're going to get back to reality and take on...
Whoops, there goes gravity. Anyway, we'll go back and we're going to fight the next boss.
Yeah, the giant red Octorok. Pete, do you have a cool wrestling name for the giant red Octorok?
I don't have a wrestling title for this. I do have an alternative name, though, similar to Chumungus.
Okay.
I got Colossorock.
That's great. I love that. No, don't sell yourself short. Colossorock is fantastic.
I'm glad you like it, because I was not sure. It is... I think this is a pretty cool boss. I think it is worthy of a pretty cool name. I cannot think for the life of me. Just say, like, big old red Octorok. That'll be the subtitle. Big old boy.
Big old boy Colossorock. I don't have anything that's going to beat that. So I guess we can get just right into the fight. Hey, Pete, do you want to describe what the giant Octorok looks like?
It's a huge red Octorok. It very much shares its overworld appearance, except it has, like, a bunch of green vines and such growing out of its back.
And one big white flower.
It's kind of cute, to be honest. Like, yeah. If we were able to get out of this place without killing it and just reach in and grab the Octorok and keep it as a pet, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, it feels like it would have, like, I don't know. I want the Octorok to roll over so I could scratch its belly.
I gotta be honest, I felt kind of bad fighting this boss.
A little bit. You're kind of... I mean, we talk a lot about Link bullying other things, and this is another example of Link bullying this creature.
Granted, I did leave this fight with half a heart, so, you know, I had to do what I had to do. But at the end of the day, like... Okay, so here's its figurine description. Frozen solid by the power of the water element. He's been frozen so long that his hunger is unbearable. He's just a hungry boy.
Aw, yeah, give him a little sweet treat.
He eats the water element. He's just looking for a little minty treat, like a little candy.
Oh, I wonder what that water element tasted like.
Oh.
Okay, we'll get to it. Let's talk about this actual fight.
Oh, it's super simple. Once you get down to the pattern, it's... the easiest thing. He's going to be spitting gigantic boulders out around you, which will break against the walls if they pass you by. You can actually deflect it with your tiny little dinky shield, which is interesting.
Oh, I didn't know that. So I fought this thing by swiping my sword and deflecting the boulders with my sword.
Oh, does the sword work?
Yeah, the sword totally works. Right on. Which is weird because at no other point in the game does the sword work for that, I think.
Well,
I might be wrong about that. No one double check me. But as you hit boulders into the mouth, it slowly starts to freeze.
Oh, right. Okay.
And after you hit two or three boulders into its mouth, it literally kind of has ice encapsulating most of it.
Yeah, it also freezes the floor, too.
And it freezes the floor around it, slowing it down and exposing its tail, which you then have to light on fire.
Yeah. This is okay. So freezing itself and also the floor, definitely a result of the ice element.
Yeah.
Of the water element. Excuse me. I don't know why I called it that.
Yeah. What? How could you make a mistake like that? Also, when you light its tail on fire, it melts the ice, which you then see kind of the water all on the ground, which is a cool touch.
It stays on fire for a bit, kind of freaking out.
Yeah, it's definitely a cool thing to light a full living creature on fire. We discussed this a couple of episodes ago with the Wizrobe.
It doesn't feel good. I don't like it.
There are multiple phases of this. Phase two darkens the room, as well as introduces falling boulders to the fight.
Right. It's throwing a tantrum, so things start to fall down.
Mm-hmm. The boss starts ramming into the walls. As Pete mentioned, it's throwing a full-on temper tantrum. And you basically, again, just wait for it to spit out rocks and hit them back at it.
And, you know, that's just, you know, three rounds of that and you're done.
Pretty much. So we beat this guy and we get the water element. Finally, thankfully, you actually get the water element in this dungeon.
Yeah, no, there's no stone tablet saying it's somewhere else.
We get a bit of text here saying water quenches thirst, ends drought, and nourishes life. The water element is the embodiment of that power.
Or it just freezes everything it touches because that's all the water element does in this game.
So we take our new element, we exit the temple, and suddenly this becomes a ghost game.
Oh yeah, that does happen right after, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. We see the ghost of the king of Hyrule, whose name is Gustav. I think I accidentally called Karlov Gustav earlier in the season. Yeah. Okay. This is why I made that mistake. We see Gustav here, who says, "Child who seeks to aid the princess of Hyrule. My name is Gustav. I was king of Hyrule countless ages ago. Stand before me. Only then will the path open to you." He then disappears, and Ezla wonders if that was just a dream. But then there is a new mark on our map, which we will be going to in the next episode after we infuse our sword with this new element.
You know, I have some questions about that appearance of Gustav, which I'm going to try and remember for next time.
Okay, note it, write it down now. So
I will.
So yeah, we're going to go to the Elemental Sanctuary now, fuse the water element into the sword, and gain the power to be three boys.
Your boy posse just got a little bit bigger.
Yep. I even have in my notes here, how fun.
I don't know. I'm ready to be rid of this mechanic at this point of the game already, I think.
Yeah.
It's neat because, like, they want to explain four swords. I'm like, okay, cool. Explain four swords if you gotta. But, like, I'm good. I think I'm good now.
It's fine. Like I said, every now and then you get a really cool puzzle. We're actually coming up on an excellent boss fight that uses this mechanic. But
oh, yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, it maybe overstays its welcome a little.
In retrospect, I kind of wish that it worked a little bit more like the Elegy of Emptiness in Majora's Mask, where you just make a clone and leave it sitting somewhere, like, you know, like a statue.
Oh, interesting.
I think that would garner about the same results as what you're doing here. It's just you don't have to aim like you're, you know what I mean? You don't have to.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't have the ability to bang into so many walls and completely screw up the puzzle you were doing.
It's so frustrating.
Well, you know what's not frustrating? Hello, Hyrule Travel Recommendations. Our T-Rex.
Nope. Mm-mm.
Hey, Pete, what is your best bite for the Temple of Droplets?
Oh, we're going straight for best bites. Right on.
You always are surprised by the order I choose. You have to remember, I have no idea what order you have in your head.
I have it written down.
I will always surprise you. I know you have it written down. We're looking at different notes, bud.
All right, fair enough. My best bite for the Temple of Droplets is a blue choo-choo shaved ice.
Ooh. Interesting.
It's a pretty easy answer.
But that's going to shock you.
I'm not so sure about that, because if it's just blue choo-choo jelly, right?
Okay, fair enough. But you're willfully removing the core of this enemy.
The core?
Which I think you have to do sometimes when you're going to eat all of these living things.
What is the core of a choo-choo? Is it the eyes?
Not the literal core. The main element of the blue choo-choo is the electricity.
I guess, but like there's... A lot of the time in these games, when you have choo-choo jelly, you can put it into a potion or something, and that doesn't shock you or kill you, so...
Fair enough. So what flavor do you see this being?
You know how to ask me that question.
So hey, Pete.
Yes, Chris.
What does a blue choo-choo in the form of a shaved ice taste like?
I'm going to say Mountain Dew Code Red.
Code Red? Isn't that the red one?
Is Code Red the red one?
Okay.
Did you just ask me that?
Okay, you're making a big... Listen, not every one of our listeners... And let's be clear, not every one of our co-hosts
knows you know
the different flavors of Mountain Dew.
I've already reconsidered. It is going to be a soda, but I'm going to go for Dr. Pepper Cream Soda.
That one I think I can piece together in my head what that tastes like.
That is a good old mixture if you're ever able to find that out there.
Okay, so you're saying this is going to taste like the ice form of a Dr. Pepper cream soda.
Well, I mean, ice form. I'm not sure you're following what I mean by shaved ice, Chris. You've had a snow cone before, yes?
Yes. No. I'm with you. I'm following
you. Like, the ice comes first, and you pour the choo-choo jelly on it.
Right. I totally get that. Yeah.
Okay.
And,
all right.
And I'm into it. I mean, I like the flavor profile of that. I don't know why that would taste like that necessarily, but...
It was mostly because it's like, because Dr. Pepper's a cherry soda, people don't really consider that. So I figured that would make sense.
With the blue choo-choo?
Yeah, I mean, blue flavors of candy and soda and stuff are entirely made up anyway, so it might as well be a fruit, you know?
Just feels like there's another creature in this dungeon you could choose if you wanted a nice cherry flavor.
I'm good.
Okay, fair enough.
What about you? What's your best bite?
I'm going with the... Octorok in the form of grilled calamari.
Hey, okay. That's a real answer.
Kind of like a family size because it is the colossal rock.
That's a good point. If you're eating it as a minish, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to ask a quick culinary question of you, Chris. Do you prefer grilled or fried calamari?
Oh, I would say fried.
Yeah, me too. I think I got to go with that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, both are good.
Because I just go for the rings, and if it's fried in ring form, it no longer resembles anything. It is just a fried ring that I can dip in marinara sauce, and it's very good.
There you go. Oh, dude. I want this right now.
Dinner time.
All right. Well, on that note, what is your photo op for Temple of Droblets?
I'm going to say my photo op would probably be riding the lily pad off of the waterfall that's in this place.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
Either that or taking a photo of the actual waterfall itself.
Nice.
What about you?
Not to be redundant, but like right outside of the frozen Octorok. Just because like then you have the scale there. You have the giant frozen thing. It's almost like you're in a museum.
A bit. It's a little macabre knowing it's still alive, but...
I mean, the other category of this is us eating the thing, so yeah.
Yeah. It's not a bad answer.
What is your alluring attraction for Temple of Droplets?
Alluring. My recommended attraction is just the lily pad ride itself.
Oh, okay.
I think it's pretty straightforward.
Lily pad ride is always going to be a good bet for the attraction.
Like, it hits most of the temple, and it, you know, and like I said, it goes over a dang waterfall. That's pretty good.
Does every rider get their own gust jar? Or do you put a motor on the back of these?
I would probably, how do they do it around like a log flume where it's like there's a hook underneath and there's mechanical bits underneath the lily pad that drags you?
That's probably the safest bet, yeah.
What about you?
For me, I would say there was that clone puzzle that I made note of earlier in the episode where you are on an ice ledge, I guess, and you clone yourself twice and... maneuver above and below a row of rock structures. I would say,
okay, like an obstacle course.
I would say freeze that out fully and make it an ice skating rink.
Right on. Okay, I'm game for that. I mean, you could also just use the room that that Colossorock is in. You could probably just ice skate in that big old room.
It would be kind of fun to ice skate around a giant frozen Colossorock.
Oh, like an ice sculpture? Yeah, that'd be kind of neat.
Yeah, I don't know. I think just like the lily pad stuff, it's always going to be fun to have an ice skating attraction.
I think it's hard to beat lily pads, to be honest.
It is a little bit hard to beat, in this game at least.
And I do not know how to ice skate, so I know which one I'm going to.
All right. Do we want to now...
step on over to the post office?
Yeah!
This week we have a letter written in from Jason. Jason writes, Hello, Hyrule. I'm Jason, and I like your podcast so much. When I'm going to school and when I'm going to my house, every day I listen to the podcast. Even on the weekends, I do it when I have time. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Another one of those, like, it's fun to think, like, we listen to so many podcasts when we do everyday stuff around the house.
Sure.
It's always nice to hear that we fit into people's everyday schedule and are able to provide that to them.
Honestly, at the end of the day, that's really all I want. Because, like, so many podcast creators have done that for me, like filling in the void of my commute and chores and such, that I want to pay it back a bit, you know?
100%. So, yeah, thank you, Jason, for writing in and letting us know.
Yeah, thanks.
I guess on that note, we can close up the post office.
Lock up for the night.
And, Pete, what are we discussing in the next episode?
Next episode, we are headed to the Royal Valley.
Ooh, we got some good stuff coming.
And the Royal Crypt.
Yes, that's what I've been waiting for. We're getting spooky.
By the way, if you want to send us a postcard, you can do so in one of two ways. You can either send us an email over at HyrulePod@gmail.com, or you can drop us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read them here on the show, and your ratings and reviews help more listeners like you find the show.
Also, if you don't mind, if you know people in your life who enjoy The Legend of Zelda, share this podcast with them.
Tell everybody that you know. Maybe don't be annoying about it.
I say, be super annoying about it. Tell everybody that you don't know. No, actually, don't do that, because then some people might start to leave us angry.
Yes, reviews. Definitely don't do that. And definitely don't go to the Apple Store and log on to every device and give us a rating or review on the devices there. Definitely don't do that.
Especially if they're 5-star.
Especially not. No, certainly. That's the worst case scenario. If you want to find us on social, you can find us on Twitter, Insta, and Tumblr at Hyrule Pod. You can also reach out to us individually on Twitter. I am at the edge of my Pete.
And I am at a man named Babs.
B-A-B-S.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Hello Hyrule. Thank you for listening. Next episode is the Royal Valley. Until then, I've been Pete.
And I've been Chris.
Excuse me, podcast.